live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Time, 6:40 p.m. Eastern on CBS. The location, Arrowhead Stadium. The weather, horrible. Maybe not as horrible, but horrible. You know, like polar vortex horrible. The line, Kansas City minus 3. Why don't we start right there? Kansas City minus 3. So, the Patriots are underdogs. And apparently for them, specifically Julian Edelman, it is a reason to go. Because he has been tweeting out a hashtag bet against us hype video. Now let me take one moment to say, Julian Edelman is a really nice football player. Edelman is a Super Bowl champion. He repeatedly crushed the Chargers on Sunday with his YAC. I like this guy. I've always liked this guy. I like him as a guy, you know, notwithstanding that PED bust. But I like him as a guy. I like his grit. I like his heart. I like what he's made out of himself. I like the fact that he competes. Man, this guy is a competitor. And the thing we know about competitors is they're going to get their edge. And a guy like that's going to have a major edge. You're going to get your edge and you're going to get your motivation and you've got to get it from somewhere. We know this. But apparently he's getting it from the fact that the Patriots are underdogs this week. And to me, that's just lame. I mean, actually, it's really lame. You know what's more lame than putting out a bet against us hype video? Selling bet against us t-shirts. And he's doing that too. You can buy a $30 t-shirt with a worthless phrase printed on it. And don't get it twisted. I respect his game a hell of a lot. And everybody's got a right to make a buck any way they choose. But against me, that's lame. I mean, seriously. This is not only very unpatriot-like, you know, the unpatriot way. It is lame. I mean, what I'm getting at is this. So people picked against you guys last week, and you proved them wrong. Congrats. That's sports. People make their picks. The picks are either right or they're wrong. You've cracked the code. But the reason people picked against you is because you had not been playing well. The Pats. It's not a shock. It's not a mystery. The Pats' defense has not shown much pass rush this year. Your Hall of Fame tight end, banged up. Fact is, you had not looked like yourselves. I mean, were you super impressed with those December losses to Miami and Pittsburgh? Or that early season loss to the league's biggest disappointment, the Jacksonville Jaguars? So you come out and you win on Sunday. You come out and you turn the Chargers inside out. You embarrassed them, you humiliated them, and anybody else who picked against you. Myself included. Congrats, you got over. You shut everybody up. It should have been enough. But apparently it's not. It wasn't. Because now they're all butthurt. And for what? Because they're underdogs going on the road to face the team with the best record in the AFC. What? What? Should Vegas make you the favorites just because you're the Patriots? Would that make you happy? Should Vegas say, yeah, the Chiefs do have the best record. The Chiefs are playing at home, and the Patriots have lost 3 of their last 4 on the road. But screw it. They're the Pats, right? Let's make them the favorite because they're the Pats, and that'll make Edelman and Tom Brady happy. Look, it's not personal to Vegas. It's business. They don't love you. They don't hate you. They love money. Also, it's not like they came out and they made you 14-point underdogs. You're 3-point underdogs. The standard rule of thumb has been the home field is worth about 3 points. So Vegas essentially is saying the two teams are even, that it's a coin flip. But you're going to get bent about that. Not only bent, but profit from it. Sell merch off it. I mean, come on. And for the record, and your edification, Tommy, nobody anywhere was saying you suck. Nobody anywhere was saying the Patriots suck. And then after that beatdown you laid on LA, believe me, nobody anywhere was disrespecting you. Again, you can make money any way you want. And if selling $30 t-shirts to Pats fans that are about how nobody respects them, if you want to do that, go ahead. I mean, that's shooting fish in a barrel, right? Pats fans will eat that up all day long. Pats fans have spent the last half decade and a half watching their team win Super Bowls and complaining that they don't get enough credit for winning Super Bowls. And if you're one of those Pats fans who wonders why that is, It's because of stuff like this. The issue isn't the winning. It's the whining. The team is great. The team is amazing. Seriously, one of the best ever. Greatest coach and quarterback combo in history. One of the greatest runs in the history of sports. Any sport. But the only thing more amazing than what you've done on the field is how some of your fans whine off of it. Again, don't get it twisted. Pats fans, people do not dislike you sometimes because you win. They dislike you because you whine and complain about not getting enough respect when you win or lose. I mean, you're underdogs for like the first time, what, ever? Ever? And you're acting like everybody said you suck. And I know Brady said that after the Chargers game, but again, nobody said they suck. People only had questions about the team, and again, for good reason. The team has been to 8 straight AFC title games. How are you not above lame-ass stuff like this? But if your argument is you need it for motivation, great. My argument would be it's the AFC title game. You're 60 minutes from the Super Bowl. Do you really need any more motivation than that? And if you need motivation and you need more of it from selling t-shirts, you know that says more about you than it does Vegas. And believe me, Edelman, he's a 2-time Super Bowl champ. He plays for a 5-time Super Bowl champ. I would not think that he would need that to get up for something like this. But at the end of the day, you know what's lamer than selling a Bet Against Us t-shirt? Buying a Bet Against Us t-shirt. I don't know where it's coming from. This whole everybody thinks we suck. Everybody disrespects us. We're dogs. Right. You're a 3-point dog like the Rams are. They're not complaining. Brady was asked about that. Like, what do you make of that, Tom? You guys are actually not favored.
You guys are 3-point underdogs going into this game. It's the first time the Patriots have been an underdog with you at quarterback in 3 or 4 years now. Just how does that feel, being the underdog going into this one?
Doesn't change much for us, but it just, you know, shows you kind of what, you know, people would think about, you know, what our chances are. That's about it.
Doesn't.
No more added comment to that.
Man, I like this guy so much better before he started talking. My guest is Freddie Roach. Freddie, my man. Nice to have
you back.
Hey,
Jim, how are you?
Good, Freddie. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
All right, Freddie, Thursday of fight week. Let me start right there. How was your camp with Manny Pacquiao? How has it gone? How does he look to you right now?
Pacquiao is doing really well. He's in great shape, and he's really ready for this fight. And I'm having a little trouble holding him back. He wanted to run this morning, but I told him this fight's too close. Let's just rest a little bit, and he's doing really well.
Freddie Roach is my guest. Freddie, let's go back for a minute. The fact that you're training Pacquiao is something of a surprise, and then at the same time, it's not a surprise. You were with him back in July of 2017 when he lost that decision to Jeff Horn in Australia. What do you remember about that fight, Freddie, especially in the later rounds, and then your conversation with Manny afterwards?
Hello?
Freddie. Hey, Freddie, can you hear me?
Yeah.
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 Oh, was that?
That last fight, it was a little, we had a little mix-up, and I did miss a fight there in between, but, you know, I was just trying to give Manny advice. It was just being a senator and being a world champion boxer is really difficult a lot of time. He had time off of this fight. He had time to get ready, and we had a really good training camp and no distractions whatsoever, and he's in great shape, and he's 100% ready to go.
We're talking to you, Freddie Roach. You know, Freddie, I was trying to get at the point also that the two of you had spent some time apart, and then in the lead-up to this fight, back in November, Manny told the media that you would, in fact, be training him. What did you think when you heard that, and had you talked to him about coming back and working with him at that point?
Well, you know, he's always a machine. He's 40 years old, but his work ethic is unbelievable, and he's still fighting like he's a 20-year-old, and he's in great shape, and 40 is just a number, but his work ethic is really, really on top of things.
Manny Pacquiao is going to fight this weekend. Freddie, so he is 40. Does he look or fight like he's 40?
No, he doesn't fight like he's 40 at all. He fights like he's 20. His punching power is better now than ever. He's really hitting hard. And I know that I work mitts with him every day, and I feel the punches, and his power is unbelievable. And he's looking really, really good. And I can't wait for this fight and get Broner out of the way.
When it gets cold out there, your vehicle needs some extra attention. O'Reilly Auto Parts has everything you need to keep your vehicle toasty warm. From choosing the right antifreeze for your engine to replacing your windshield wiper blades, O'Reilly will help get your car or truck in fighting shape for the cold weather ahead. O'Reilly Auto parts, better prices every day. All right, so when you look at Adrian Broner right now as a fighter, what kind of a fighter do you see? What's he look like to you?
Broner is more of a counterpuncher, and he doesn't like to take the lead too much. He's he'll wait on us, and he won't. We'll definitely be the aggressor in this fight, and we'll have to take the fight to him.
Do you feel like Broner throws the volume of punches that he needs to throw to win a fight like that? And what kind of shape is he in right now?
Yeah, that's the problem. Broner doesn't throw – his volume isn't deep enough. He doesn't throw enough volume punches. He's just one-two counter punch. And, man, he's going to really, really, really outdo him with the number of punches landed. And, man, these combinations, he's not going to be able to handle that.
You know, Freddie, you look at Manny. Manny's done everything there is to do in boxing. He's got a lot of different things he could be doing outside of boxing, politics, and more. How do you explain his drive and the motivation that he has right now to continue to fight and train and prepare?
Yeah, he's a machine. And again, 40, it seems late in the game. But Manny, he's working like he's a 20-year-old, and his work ethic is unbelievable. And the first time it starts slowing down, I will tell him, and then that'll be time when he gets out.
Freddie, did you have that conversation with him after the Horn fight? Did you ever sit down and say, it is time to get out, you are slowing down?
Yeah, we sat down and had that conversation after the Horn fight, and that's why I missed one fight. He was just a little upset because, I told him, I said, the thing is, to be a senator and a world champion at the same time is very difficult. Especially when he's in session, and when sometimes he gets out at 3 p.m, sometimes at 10 p.m. at night, and that's what time we have to train. And the training schedule is really sporadic. And but for this fight, they gave us time off and gave us time to get ready for the fight. And training camp was the same as always, just every day on time and ready to go.
Freddie Roach is my guest. Freddie, one thing you mentioned, the fight that you missed, that was the championship fight where he fought for the welterweight title. Did you watch that fight? And if so, what was it like for you to watch that fight after spending all those years with him?
Yeah, I did watch that fight. I watched that fight on TV, and he fought a very good fight. And that was his first knockout in 6 years. And I think he has that feeling back, and knows how good that feels when you knock an opponent out. And I think that'll happen in this one also.
Okay, I was going to say, so how do you see this one going, and how do you see this one ending?
Well, at 40, he still throws the heat. So, Broner is a slow starter, and we're going to jump on him right away. And I hopefully Manny gets him out there early. It'll be exciting, but the thing is, I just don't think Broner can keep up with the volume of punches.
You know, if there's anything more tired and more lame than even the Pats calling themselves underdogs, Tom Brady saying everybody thinks we suck and can't win a game, if there's something even worse than that, and at this point there's not, but something in the same conversation is that slow motion divorce going on in Pittsburgh between the Steelers and Antonio Brown. Now, remember, that busted out in the locker room and hit the streets back in week 17. Since then, it's only gotten bigger, uglier, and even worse for pretty much all parties involved, but especially AB. Now, earlier this week, new Tampa Bay Bucks head coach Bruce Arians was asked about Brown. BA coached AB his first 2 years in the league. Arians had a front row seat. He watched Brown go from a sixth round draft pick to a rookie with just 16 catches for 167 yards to a second-year stud who made the Pro Bowl with over 1,100 yards receiving. And we know B.A. is going to shoot you straight. In a podcast that he sat down for with Adam Schefter, he said what a lot of people are saying. He said that Brown was acting like a, quote, diva. And he said, quote, "This isn't the Antonio that was drafted in 2010, end quote. That's not all. Then there's former teammate Emmanuel Sanders. Sanders was getting in some reps as an analyst on the NFL Network when he was asked about AB. And the answer he gave was firm, it was fair, and it came from a position of experience and knowledge."
It all sounds familiar. But one thing I will say is, man, when Art Rooney came out and said that, it's pretty much he's gone. Because being around the Pittsburgh Steelers organization, Art Rooney doesn't say too much, but when he says something, he means it. And so this situation has really, really got out of hand. And it's crazy because I don't like to see it. But I feel like Antonio brought it on himself. You cannot turn your back on your brothers and not only the Pittsburgh Steelers organization who gave you an opportunity to make you who you are in terms of Antonio Brown, the football player. And so for you to leave on a Wednesday and then have your agent call on a Sunday is the ultimate disrespect to the Pittsburgh Steelers organization. That's why Art Rooney feels the way that he feels.
That's a really strong statement. A really strong statement from a really credible guy. Now, maybe if you're Antonio Brown or you're on his side, you might say, yeah, but that guy's got a bone to pick, right? Like Emmanuel Sanders was there and then Antonio Brown became a one and Sanders is no longer there and he's got his own agenda. Yeah, maybe. But is there anything that he said that didn't seem fair? I mean, that's a fair statement by a guy who knows all the parties, who was right there in the middle of it. And, you know, he came in to do a job. His job being like, I'm on the NFL Network and they asked me a question about a guy that I played with. I was in that locker room. I was there. I know. So that's as good of an answer as you're going to get from another guy who knows what he's talking about. Of course, AB did not see it that way. AB felt like Sanders had his own agenda, that his agenda was to go there and talk about him. AB also heard what Bruce Arians had to say, and he was not going to take that either. Essentially, AB is responding to everything. At AB84 tweeted, "Arians didn't draft me. He drafted Emmanuel Sanders. Same guy who missed rehab to go on networks to talk about me on situation he has zero clue. Arians now wears Kangol hats and glasses, crying face emoji, but I'm a diva. Done seen it all then. They say we friends. Stop lying." End of tweet. So again, AB is not going to let anything lie. He's responding to everything. And I got to be honest, when I saw that tweet, I immediately wished that I had not. Now, just seeing that tweet made me feel like Jim Mora Sr. after somebody told him that the Saints season was over after three games.
I hate to hear that.
That's how I felt when I saw AB's tweet. Like, man, I hate to see that.
I hate to hear that.
AB, man, stop. Stop. You got to step back from Twitter, step back from Instagram. Man, step back from teasing some big interview that's supposed to be coming and then never does. I think 500,000 Steeler fans started following James Harrison on the gram, and all they've gotten since then are some pointers on how to dumbbell press a dump truck and some random Bruce Lee quote. Because Sanders clapped back on Twitter and served his second dose of reality this week. Four crying face emojis followed by this. Quote, he directed this at Antonio. Quote, "You know damn well I didn't travel to LA to talk about you, fam. You tripping, yo. I went to be an analyst in which you acting foolish was the topic and I gave my analytical opinion. Get off the gas, yo. You did it to yourself. Get off the gas, yo. You did it to yourself." You know, there's something to it. In fact, there's more than something to it. I'm not sure I could have said that better myself. I mean, every day that passes makes this breakup more and more inevitable. Art Rooney II got in front of the local media yesterday, and he did not back off the statements that he made from last week, where he said it was, quote, hard to envision AB being with the team next year. Essentially, he doubled down. And remember, Sanders said on NFL Network, Art Rooney does not have much to say publicly. If he's saying something like that, then it pretty much means it is over. And while I can't even imagine a scenario, here, this is a key point. I cannot imagine a scenario where Brown or the Steelers are better off without each other. This brawl is not dying out. If anything, it's picking up. Former Steeler coaches and players are now jumping in, and they're throwing haymakers, and they're landing them. The brand and the business that AB has built, both on and off the field, over the past 9 years is no longer booming. And I've said it before, and I'll say it again. This is an AB house. This is an AB house. He is one of the most electric playmakers I've ever seen. He is one of the best receivers I've ever seen. This guy's work ethic is incredible. He's fierce. I like AB. I like AB. I don't like this scenario at all. So for the sake of this team, for the sake of this dude and this team, let me say this. AB, get off the gas, yo.
Yo.
You did it to yourself. You're not making it better. I know you're proud. I know you feel like you have to respond. I wouldn't. Not anymore. You're digging yourself a big hole. Nothing Sanders said to me was unfair. Nothing Arian said was unfair. Dude, you've earned everything you have. But you're digging yourself a hole. Man, get off the gas, yo. Steve Prohm is my guest. Steve, good to have you back. How are you?
Good. How you doing, Jim? Thanks good. For having me on.
Great to have you on. So last night you went into that game and you were coming on the back of two straight losses. Steve, you know the expectations at Iowa State, and there have been thoughts in some corners that, oh no, the sky is falling. But each of those losses were close. So what was your mindset going into last night? Were you at all worried, or were you fired up about the challenge of facing a really good Texas Tech club in their place?
No, I think Sunday morning when you got up and were able to put the Kansas State game behind you and you spent all day watching tape on Tech and preparing for them, I started feeling really good about, you know, having an opportunity to put ourselves in a position to win. You know, whether we'd win or lose, you know, who knows. But I thought our preparation would be really good and our focus would be good, and that we've got great respect for that team. Chris Beard's done an amazing job, and they're the number one defensive team in the country for a reason. But we knew it wasn't everybody, you know, kind of said must win. I don't know if it's a must win, but it was a game we need to go down there and play well and kind of regain our chemistry and regain a little bit of our swagger that we lost the previous week. And, you know, we were able to get off to a really good start. And I think Coach Beard mentioned this in his press conference. You know, we really won the game in the first half. Offensively, really efficient. We didn't turn it over.
Steve Prohm, my guest, you know, I've got so much respect for Chris Beard. I know you do, too. I can hear it in the way you're talking about him right now. And you know they're going to get after you on defense. They came into last night second in the nation in field goal defense, but you shot 44% from the field last night. What was your approach going into the game?
Share the ball. I think that's one of the things. When you start four guards, I think, and we bring off, you know, really, you know, one of our best players right now, you know, Wigginton, he's really a starter as well. But he's been injured and he's come back from injury. And so, you know, we really have got five perimeter guys that are starters that can really pass, dribble, and shoot. And so our biggest thought process going down there was we've got to make them move. We've got to have them in rotation all night as much as we possibly can. And we've got to share the ball. And I think when people have watched us play this year and when we're playing the right way and sharing the ball, I think we're a very effective offensive team.
Steve Prohm joining us. You know, it's not just what you did on offense. It's also what you did on defense against Jarrett Culver. There's a good chance he's going to be a top 10 pick in the draft. You held him, though, to 7 of 21 shooting. How pleased were you with the way your guys showed up on defense against him specifically?
Well, you've got to get stops down there so you're able to play in transition. You know, the more, you know, they did a good job in the second half kind of junking things up against us. But the more you give up, you know, free throws, the more you foul, the more the games get slowed down, the more they put you, you know, in a half-court setting, and we wanted to play in transition and in space. And so, you know, one of the biggest focal points was we've got to be great defensively. Culver's terrific. I think they did a great job in the second half of just isolating him and putting him in situations where he could draw fouls, and they got into the bonus early. Fortunately for us, you know, there wasn't a great free throw shooting night for them, but I was proud of the way Nick Babb and our other guys competed against Culver, which like you mentioned, he's got a bright future playing this game.
We're talking Iowa State basketball. Head coach Steve Prohm is my guest. So with last night's win and then the win over Kansas, you've got two top 10 wins this season. What does that tell you about the upside and how good this team can be this year?
Well, I've liked this team really since the spring. We kind of, you know, we had a tough year last year. A lot of new faces, lost a lot of really good players after my second year, and knew it was kind of be a rebuilding year. But once that season was over, we had a couple transfers sitting out, Mariel Shayok, Mike Jacobson, and we just really preached about sharing the ball and playing the right way and representing Iowa State the right way. And, you know, I've had a really good feeling about this team from the spring into the summer, into the fall. We've had our fair share of adversity with suspensions and injuries. But I think if we collectively can do the right things, and our big quote is don't seek honor, honor will find you. If we can buy into that and buy into our other kind of our core values of our program, I think this team, if we're selfless and we defend, I think we can do some special things this year.
And Steve, the conference is fierce. I've had a number of Big 12 coaches on this year. Every single one of them has talked about how competitive the conference is, what a grind it is on a nightly basis. I mean, you can't win in that conference if you don't have a locker room full of competitors. So when you're out recruiting, what is it that you look for that lets you know that you found a guy who can win on the road in the Big 12?
I think it's I kind of grew up under this, and they're working for Billy Kennedy, who's at Texas A&M now. It's, you know, it goes down to character, number one, and then having a great toughness about you. You know, character, toughness, and ability. I mean, those are the three things. And now I think the way the game's gone, basketball IQ is so important. But, you know, the guys I think you need and that have been successful here at Iowa State are guys that love to play, guys that put a ton of time in the gym on their own. That's why right now we've got, you know, several former guys, I think five former guys right now in the NBA, with a couple with the Jazz, the Thunder, and then Monte Morris with the Nuggets. And so, but those guys individually put a lot of time in. And so, but I think character and a toughness and just an ability to love the game, I think that's the biggest key.
Steve Prohm joining us. You know, I mentioned in the intro that it's your fourth season at Iowa State. Man, how is that possible? I remember when you and I talked right after you were hired. So what do you know about this job maybe now that you didn't know when you first arrived?
Watching it from the outside, you know, when I was at Murray State, it's a job that I knew if it ever opened, it would one that I would love to be involved in, just because it has so many of the characteristics that I want in a program if I was going to move my family. You know, it's got a great community. It's got an unbelievable fan base. They've got a great passion for not just basketball, but every single sport here. And they've got a lot of pride in their school. And I love college towns and small college towns. And so I thought this would be a really good fit. And, you know, the one thing, I don't know if there's anything I've really learned more that I didn't maybe know on the outside. But the one thing I guess you're just reassured of is just how great this fan base is. I think it's a top five fan base in the country. I think Hill of Magic's one of the elite places to play college basketball, and that we've got really, really good people, not just in Ames, Iowa, not just Iowa State fans, but in this whole state in general.
Now, Steve, a final topic. I think that maybe you touched on this a little bit when I said, what kind of person or player are you looking to recruit that can win on the road in that conference? But I thought you made an interesting point over the summer when you told The Athletic, quote, I always said recruiting other good players will happen. We'll get other good players in here and other good talent. The hardest thing over time is to get back the culture of how we want to do things on an everyday basis. I'm telling you, culture is a word that comes up the most when I talk to coaches in any sport at all. So how would you define the culture that you want in your program?
Well, we're getting back to it. You know, the number one thing, you know, we talked about is, and this are kind of our five keys. It's, you know, being selfless, being responsible, being present daily. You know, then we just had a saying that, you know, we had Eric Thomas come speak to us, and then it's like, you know, with all these situations that come about, you've got decisions to make. Well, every time you make a decision, you got to ask yourself, then what? You know, then what? Well, what's it going to produce, good or bad, if you make that decision? And so, you know, we talked to our guys about that last night of, you know, can you be selfless? Can you be responsible? Can you be present? And then the other thing we talk about is one more. Can you do something extra for somebody, you know, that can't repay you? And if you can do that, you know, we'll win games, but you're going to be men. And that's the biggest thing is, you want to develop men that can represent your program in this university the right way. And that's what I think we're most proud of here right now, is how great all of these former guys are doing here. And Fred Hoiberg's got a ton to do with that, probably way more than I do, because he brought the majority of them here. And I think our culture slipped a little bit last year because of the turnover. You know, we got lost guys like Monte Morris, Burton, Naz Long, Matt Thomas that had been here for so long that we had to kind of reintroduce our culture. And, you know, it took a little bit longer than we would wanted. But guys like Mariel Shayok and Mike Jacobson and, you know, Nick Weiler Bad, those guys, and along with many others, we really like our freshmen too, have been able to step up and kind of reinstill the culture that we want.
Yeah, Steve, I know it's speculation, just speculation on your part, but you mentioned Fred Hoiberg. Do you think that Fred has unfinished business in the pro game, or do you think that he might want to make a return to the college game?
Well, I talk to him, you know, every now and then. We don't really talk, you know, that in-depth about basketball and job. From a job standpoint, we talk more basketball and how things are going here. And he's been an unbelievable resource for me during my time here. But I hope he gets another chance in the NBA. You know, I think he's a brilliant coach. He's an unbelievable man, and he's been really good to me. And Chicago, obviously, we all know the situation that he had there wasn't, you know, the most ideal. And so, you know, hopefully, you know, he can get back in there at the NBA this year. Would be terrific. But wherever he ends up as a coach, he's going to be really successful, because I know the way the guys that played for him that I coached, I know the way that they felt about him and the impact that he had on those guys.
Iowa State coming off a huge win over Texas Tech last night, and they're right back at it. They are going up against Oklahoma State on Saturday. Always a battle in the Big 12. Steve Prohm, my guest. Steve, great to get caught up, and I appreciate the time so much. Thank you very much. Steve, have a great day.
You too. Thanks, Jim.
If you saw Ersan Ilyasova's name popping up on Twitter last night, you may have thought that the big man had passed away. Good news, he did not die. Not literally. Bad news, he died spiritually. His soul was snatched from the rest of us. And the man responsible for that theft was one Jamichael Green. Go ahead, roll it.
His competitive nature off of the bench.
Oh! Jamichael Green blocking foul on Ilyasova.
You said we don't have guys that enough guys to finish above the rim.
Well, what do you call this? One-hand spike by Jamichael as Ilyasova. Get all over the poster.
Get all over the poster is right. If you saw that on CBS Sports Network or you've seen the video, it's filthy, it's sick, it's twisted, it's disgusting. Quick note here. That was not your typical Twitter dunk explosion. That wasn't Ersan going up to block a dunk and getting posterized. That was him sliding over to take a charge and Green ripping his soul. In fact, I think I'd like to see that one more time.
His competitive nature off of the bench.
Oh! Jamichael Green blocking.
You said we don't have guys that enough guys to finish above the rim.
Well, what do you call this? One-hand spike by Jamichael as Ilyasova. Get all over the poster.
Poor Ilyasova. We hardly knew ya. But while that was the dunk of the year, it was not the performance of the night. No, that goes to James Edward Harden Jr. Let's talk about the level that Harden's playing at right now. He scored 57 Monday night. Pretty impressive. You want to know what's really impressive? He scored 57 Monday night, and I barely mentioned it on the Tuesday show because that's the level he's at right now. You see the guy go off for 57, and it's like, yeah, that's just a beard. Whatever. I mean, sure, he can go off for 57 in a night, but can he do it twice in a single week? Yes, because he did it twice in 3 days. He chased Monday's 57 with 58 last night against the Nets, 58. And he did it with a really slow start. He had 14 in the first half, then he went off for 22 in the third quarter, and then he hit 50 in perfect Harden fashion.
Both teams have a foul to give before they get into the penalty. 7 seconds on the shot clock. Harden steps back over Karutz. Got it. There was almost another man down.
Almost pulled game.
This guy cleared about 30 feet of space. He cleared about 30 feet of space with that jab step and that step back. Absolutely textbook. Man, you know James Harden has reached a new level when you see a highlight like that and you're impressed that the defender didn't just quit and find a new line of work after it happened. I know I would have. So what's the next level? What's that new level? two games, 115 points. We're moving out of MJ and Kobe territory and into Wilt Chamberlain territory. In fact, Harden and Chamberlain are the only two guys in history with back-to-back 55-point games. The only difference being, Chamberlain was like a giant amongst men. Harden is like a man amongst giants. Hey-o. He's got 18 straight games of at least 30. 18 straight games of at least 30, which is the longest streak like that since the Stilt did it back 20 straight times more than 50 years ago. Think about that. Let me just stop on that for a minute. More than a half a century of basketball, more than a half a century of guys like Kareem, Dr. J, Bird, MJ, Kobe, LeBron. Nobody's done that until now. None of those guys did that until Harden. We haven't hit the All-Star break yet. But if you want to give this guy the MVP right now, I'm not going to argue with you. And I don't think anybody else would either. The team was dead at the start of the season. He has single-handedly dragged them right back with some of the most jaw-dropping basketball you're ever going to see. And yes, I said single-handedly because he's doing it without Chris Paul, and now he's doing it without Clint Capella. This guy literally is a one-man team. His assists are down the last two games because he's running out of guys to pass it to. And the fact that he's doing it on a nightly basis and you're getting used to it doesn't mean that it's not spectacular. Nets coach Kenny Atkinson said, quote, "I'm speechless how good he is. It changed everything. How you coach. We're doing things we've never done before. He's changing the way the game is played. He's revolutionary." That is an amazing quote. Like, they said things like that about Chamberlain 50 years ago. He's changing the way the game is played. We're changing the way we coach. He's revolutionary. I mean, they didn't say things like that about LeBron or Mike or Kobe or Larry, but they're saying it about Harden. And again, for some of you, it's still not enough. For some of you, this guy's boring. For some of you, this guy's a cheater because he goes to the free throw line so much. It's kind of like saying that an NFL team throwing screen passes is cheating. It's not. Harden's not. Nobody said Tom Brady cheated when he kept running screens at the Chargers. It's because it was there, because it worked. The guy keeps getting to the free throw line. You know why he keeps going to the free throw line? Because guys keep fouling him. He's not a cheater. He's a cheat code. And no, they didn't win, but that does not take anything away from his performance. I mean, yeah, he was pissed that they lost. He was pissed that they blew a late lead, and it was a bad lead to blow. Brutal to be up six with 30 seconds left in regulation and still lose in overtime. I mean, there was a time when you'd be able to clown a team for blowing a late lead to Brooklyn. But have you seen the Nets lately? I mean, have you seen them lately? Because they've got Jarrett Allen doing things like this.
Harden still got a chance, 4 seconds left to get the final shot. And he has it blocked by Allen.
Jarrett Allen, a presence defensively.
What a block. So impressive.
Come on, Jarrett.
Not only that, they also have Spencer Dinwiddie hitting one clutch shot after another. Spencer Dinwiddie doesn't just have one of the best names in the NBA. He had 16 points in the final minute of regulation and overtime. So let me say something that I did not think that I would say ever again. Check this. The Brooklyn Nets are coming. They're building something, and they have done it without much in the way of draft picks. But last night was not about their future. It's about Harden's present. Man, you better take notice. You better soak this all in because there's no telling how long it's going to last. But when it's over, we might not see anything like it for another 50 years because we haven't seen anything like it in the last 50 years. And I don't care that it happened during a loss. Paul Flannery is my guest. Good to have you back, Paul. Happy New Year. How are you?
Happy New Year, Jim. I don't know if that's a big list for people to for that accomplishment, but I appreciate it.
Hey, Eric Burns is on that list. You're on that list. It's actually not a bad list at all. All right, so I'll hit you on that a little bit later, right? All right, so a lot of different places to start in the NBA today, but let me start with Boston. The Celtics trail the Raptors 36-30 at the end of the first quarter. Then they follow that up with a 34-17 second quarter. Paul, given everything that's been swirling around the Celtics, how significant was the quarter and what they did the rest of the way?
I thought it was huge. I thought it was absolutely huge. And as I was watching it, I think I even tweeted, this is the best quarter of basketball they played all season. I'm not saying they were teetering on the brink, but you could see the outline of the brick from there. You know, if they had another bad night, I'm not sure how this would have gone, but they really pulled it together. And what made it so good, Jim, was that they got contributions from everybody they need to get contributions from. From Kyrie Irving, who was magnificent, all the way down to Jaylen Brown, Terry Rozier, and Hayward off the bench. It was the perfect example of what the Celtics want to be in a big game against, frankly, a team they're going to have to compete with in the playoffs this spring. So, yeah, it was huge.
All right, so let's finish that thought. I mean, hard to say that a mid-January game would be make or break, especially when you've got Brad Stevens as your coach and there's so much talent on that roster. But when you look at it, I mean, how big was that win last night for this group?
They needed it, and they needed to just take a big, deep breath, right? Because they're not as bad as they played. They know that. But, you know, things have been escalating around this team. You know, a couple of losses, and they start, you know, they start looking inward and start, you know, Kyrie pointed some fingers over the weekend and it rubbed some guys the wrong way. So I don't think any of it – the thing about this team, Jim, is nobody has an agenda necessarily. They want to do the right thing. They just haven't been doing it consistently.
Paul Flannery joining us on the program. All right, I'm glad you brought Kyrie up. In saying that he regretted that what he said to LeBron – he called him over the weekend and said he apologized for, quote, being that young player that wanted everything at his fingertips. First of all, what do you make of that?
I thought it was interesting on a couple of levels. I mean, it's Kyrie playing three-dimensional chess. On the one hand, he's saying that he's acknowledging that he was a young knucklehead. At the same time, he's acknowledging that he's dealing with some young knuckleheads, right? But I think the part that people are missing here is that my take on it was that Kyrie was essentially, he noted he was apologizing for, he shouldn't have been calling guys out. He said, Jaylen Brown was right. I shouldn't have done that. And I think what he was saying was, like, this doesn't work on these young guys. I know it didn't work on me, and so I have to figure out a new way of dealing with it. You know, I made for some good Kyrie content. I don't know. People are taking it 15 different ways, which is classic Kyrie.
It's interesting. Was he on any level right to call out those young knuckleheads? Was he right in saying what he was saying?
Let me quantify knuckleheads, too, because they are good guys. They're not knuckleheads. They're just young, and they're feeling themselves. They're trying to figure out their place in the league. But, yeah, I think that those guys, in particular, we're talking about Jaylen Brown, we're talking about Terry Rozier, and we're talking about Jason Tatum. Those three guys have not played as well as they need to play this year, and there's other guys who haven't as well. But I think when they're looking internally at what's happened here, those are the three guys. And sometimes that's unfair because, you know, who asked them to carry the load? But they feel like they can, so there's this push and pull. That's the whole team dynamic at play here. Those are the three guys that people look at. They're the guys I look at for a barometer of how the Celtics are playing, where they're playing together and connected.
We're talking to Paul Flannery. So when you look at what they did last season without Gordon Hayward and Kyrie, especially in the postseason, the expectation was these guys would just take off with both those guys coming back, but that has not happened. So we're talking about it, but when you get right to it, what is your sense as to the identity and the chemistry of this team both on and off the floor and in the locker room right now?
They don't have one yet, which is weird. Marcus Morris even said that over the weekend. He's one of the truth tellers in there. He said, we don't have an identity yet. He's right. I mean, they started off the year not being able to play offense at all, but locked in defensively. Okay, fine. That's the way it's been. Then they switched that. They've been lights out offensively, haven't played connected defense. And so I think it's a developing situation. I think what you're seeing Kyrie start to assert himself as a leader. If you talk to them last year, their leaders were Al Horford and Aaron Baines. And that's a different kind of mindset than what you have when you have an abject superstar taking the reins. And so there's a little bit of push and pull. Like I said, I think everybody wants to do the right thing here. I also think this team is going to breathe a huge sigh of relief after the trade deadline, whether or not Danny Ainge does anything, and he's given no indication that he will. But I think for all those guys, they can say, okay, like, we're not going anywhere for the next 3 months. Like, it's time. We got to go play now. We got a chance to do something special. So I think you'll start to see them kick into gear as this goes along. But, Jim, I talk to people who think they're absolutely getting out of the East. I haven't seen it yet. And I haven't seen it consistently. Until they win games on the road, until they win games when it's hard, like last night, but on the road as well, then I'm going to have my doubts.
Well, and to that point, Paul, you raised a really interesting question in a piece for SB Nation yesterday. Quote, are we ready for a world in which game one of the NBA Finals is held in either Milwaukee or Toronto? So let me turn that around on you. Are you ready for that?
Not really.
What would that look like and feel like?
I think we should be. I think we should be because if I look at the East, I mean, they are clearly the two best teams. And I have questions. I have questions about Milwaukee and whether or not the style of defense they play will be successful in the playoffs. That has always been the question with Mike Budenholzer's teams. And then with Toronto, look, I know they got different guys, but they're carrying around tons of negative baggage, and they're very dependent on Kyle Lowry. So I definitely have questions about those two teams, but I haven't seen Philly ready to take that jump, and I haven't seen Boston. We just talked about them. And I love Indiana. I think they're great, but they're not that good, in my opinion. I think they're good enough to beat somebody and maybe steal a series that people don't expect them to, but I don't think they're good enough to take it all the way. You're really looking at Milwaukee or Toronto, and if this, you know, unless the Warriors decide to go on a run and win 20 in a row, the team that one of those two teams is going to have the best record in the league.
Paul Flannery joins us. Now, what about the Raptors? If they make the NBA Finals, what do you think that means for Kawhi Leonard and his decision-making? Could you really see him leaving Toronto in that scenario?
But I was talking to somebody about this last night, and nobody knows what he's going to do. And that's you know, with Kawhi, he has just kept a complete stone face about the whole situation. He seems happy. He seems fine. But there are not a lot of people who have really any serious intel on what he's going to do. A lot of people still think he's going to go west. He's going to go to the Clippers. You know, but I'm with you. I mean, you know, like Durant even said if OKC had beaten Golden State, no way he could have joined them. You know, things change. Things change in the heat of the playoffs. I don't know if that affects Kawhi at all. They've executed the strategy to put him in this position. It'd be weird if he kind of blinked right now. It's a pretty good situation for him in Toronto, but, you know, San Antonio was a good situation too.
Kawhi's Kawhi. Who knows what he's going to do? Nobody knows what he'll do. Now, Paul, you mentioned Philadelphia. Jimmy Butler, of course, had less than a positive impact on team chemistry in his last two stops. Right. What do you make of how he's fitting in with Philadelphia so far?
That's an interesting way to put it. Yeah, I mean, he's imploded two teams. I mean, you know, I think you have three guys who are in Embiid, Simmons, and Jimmy. You know, they all do things differently, and they want to do it their way, and they're trying to you know, wrestle for control a little bit here. I mean, the fit is not ideal. A lot of times when you get these mega teams that come together super fast, the fit is not ideal. We all got spoiled by, like, the 2008 Celtics. Their fit was perfect. It doesn't always work that way. My take on them is they've got talent for days, and it's the kind of talent that can win in the playoffs because Jimmy Butler is a stone-cold killer in the postseason and in the regular season too. I mean, that's a guy I want on my side. At the same time, you know, you got to put up with him for 6 months to get that. Mm-hmm. So I think they're going to have some bumps along the way. To me, they are dangerous and a wild-card team, and if they make the right kind of moves at the deadline and add a couple of veterans on the buyout market, whatever – you know, I think they are absolutely as dangerous as anybody.
Now, Paul, I can't believe that we got to the end of the interview or near the end without my bringing up James Harden. He went for 57 and 58 in consecutive games. Chris Paul is out. Clint Capella is out. Eric Gordon missed time during this run. This guy's doing this pretty much on his own. It's not like teams are not trying to stop him. How do you explain what he's doing?
I mean, he's he's the most complete offensive player in the world right now. And he's impossible to guard, and he's impossible to guard in this environment, in this era, with the way they call games. He takes the rules to the absolute limit, and he's impossible to officiate. So he really makes you do all that. You know, he's amazing. He's awesome. My only question, which is the question everybody else has, is how long can he keep this up? Because we're in January, and it's not April, and it's not the spring. And then when you get to the playoffs, what's going to happen when he gets triple teamed? If Chris Paul is not able to sort of become Chris Paul again. So that's the danger. That's the concern. But right now, it's just awesome to watch. I mean, he's amazing.
All right. So I mentioned off the top, you are the most prolific distance runner in the history of this show. You did tweet a couple of weeks back, optimism is signing up for a 50K with a nagging injury that won't go away. So when is the 50K, and how is the injury these days?
50K is in April, second week of April, which I think is the second Sunday when the playoffs start. That's how I judge my calendar. Injury has gone away. I'm feeling good. I'm feeling primed. Ran in the freezing cold this morning, and knocking out about 50 to 60 miles a week.
I was just going to say, so when you're prepping for a 50K, what is a normal training week like, 50 to 60 miles?
Yeah, anywhere from 40 to 60, depending on what I'm doing.
What is the long run?
The long run I do by hours, and so I'm up to 4 hours now.
Wow.
And I'd like to get up to 5.
Really?
Yeah.
All right. What's the pace of a run like that?
Well, the pace is different because it's in the woods, and so you're dealing with, you know, you're dealing with climbing, and you're dealing with power hiking, and you're dealing with stopping, you know, you have to fuel and all that kind of stuff. So the pace is different than a road pace, but, you know, 12-minute miles in that kind of environment with that kind of up and down, and where I run is really gnarly on the East Coast. That's pretty good.
You ever, and I only ask you this because it would happen to me, I've got no sense of direction at all, like none whatsoever. You ever get lost in the woods?
Oh, yeah. Sure.
What do you do?
Absolutely.
How do you navigate your way back?
You know, I got as high up as I possibly could and was able to see sort of a way out. And I had to go a little bit off trail, which I don't like doing because I don't like cutting through backcountry. But, you know, at some point I had to get back to where I needed to go because I was completely turned around, twisted around. And so I was able to get out of there. Where I run is not so remote as like the American West, where you could be out there for days without anybody finding you. Where I run is a pretty urban environment. So I can always, you know, have a general sense. I'm never more than 3 miles away from where I need to be.
Is there wildlife?
Sure. I've seen a coyote. I have yet to see a bear.
I've seen a bear. I was in Montana once and I ran to a couple of bears, man. That is scary. That's not something you want to see. There's nothing cool about that.
No, I ran to a moose in Colorado, but
same.
I wasn't experienced.
Yeah, they're mean. So you don't want any part of a moose
they
either.
They are mean.
Grandpa Pat in Vancouver. Hey, Pat, are you really Matt's grandfather?
Oh, hello there, Jimmy. First time, long time. I can confirm I am his grandfather. In fact, based on him and Trench's recent meteoric rise to fame, we have I've dumped Matt's grandmother, and I am now dating a 21-year-old Instagram model. But on to Allen, Ontario. He comes on here bad-mouthing two of the greatest Canadians ever in the jungle, Al. I challenge you to a 4:45 a.m. black coffee drinking contest over a game of cribbage. Wart, you cannot say you are ashamed of these young men. They are making the show better than it's ever been. And War, cribbage. War, waking up at 4 o'clock in the morning. War. Oh, shit. I forgot the last one.
That's not a good call. No.
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
Grandpa Pat. I don't know. Grandpa Pat sounded like Matt. Anyway, Grandpa Pat just wore cribbage, waking up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and then he went four-letter bomb and said, oh, I forgot the other one. Did he challenge him to a cribbage match? To a cribbage and black coffee drinking match? Why the hell not? I'll do it. Grandpa Trench. What's up, Gramps?
Well, hey there, Rome. Yeah, I got something for Grandpa Joe out in Ontario. Now hit pause on your shuffleboard match, old man, and listen up. You want to take a run at the Prodigy, then you got to come see about me first. Now let me tell you something you already know. The jungle ain't all sunshine and rainbows. It's a very mean and nasty place, and I don't care how tough you are, it will beat you to your knees and keep you there permanently if you let it. You, me, or nobody is going to hit as hard as the jungle. But it ain't about how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward. How much you can take and keep moving forward. That's how winning is done. Now, I suggest you go get your weekly colonoscopy with Dr. Rex before you come back and get your ass whooped, you hear me? Stick to playing Go Fish with Rick and Buffalo if you can't handle the heat, old man. Now, I got to get back to the weights. You take care, Rob.
Grandpa Trench going all Rocky Balboa with it.
Good night now!